is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now,
Dom Alessio with you this morning on Triple J. We do have Dr. Carl in the house.
Do I have the AKG pointing at me?
You have the little sign pointing at you. Look
that's
at that.
Good
morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Dom. How are you today?
I'm really, really good. And we have a whole bunch of people calling in. If you have a science question for Dr. Carl, give us a call right now. 1-300-055-36. We're going to kick off in Adelaide with Tom. Good morning, Dr. Tom.
Morning, Dr. Dom. Dr. Carl, how are you today?
Very well, thank you, Dr. Tom. You got a question or an answer for us?
Yeah, I do. I'm a semi driver, and some time ago I was unloading the inside of my trailer where a mouse ran out from underneath the pallet I was trying to lift. And I chased after it, because that's what I do, and the mouse went straight towards the end of the trailer, jumped off the end, hit the ground, and kept on running. What I'm wondering is, it would have been a good 1.5-metre drop that the mouse sustained, appeared to have absolutely no injury whatsoever, and comparatively, I suppose, yeah, that would have been like me jumping off a 4-metre height and still running hell for leather. I mean, yeah, how can an animal like that be able to do that?
Luckily, we have some groundbreaking research done back in 1989 and followed up in Nature by Doctors Whitney and Melhoff, reported in the American journal called the Journal of the American Veterinary Association, dealing with falling cats. And what they did was they looked at cats falling out of buildings. And the key term that you need to know here, Dr. Tom, you ready? You're paying attention. There will be an exam on this, right? Here it is. Terminal velocity.
Right.
Now, when something falls, there are two forces acting upon it in our atmosphere. The first force is gravity, because as you know, according to Newton, gravity sucks.
It does.
The second force is the wind resistance. In physics, you can normally break practically any situation down into two forces in opposite directions. So, for a human, say for a mouse, I reckon the top speed would have been maybe 30 kilometres per hour. You could drop it off the top of Everest. It wouldn't go faster. For a cat, the top speed is 100 kilometres per hour. And it turns out that a cat is just able to survive. And it turns out in a study done in America that the most dangerous height for a cat to fall from was 7 stories, because they've reached their top speed after 5 stories. And as they're falling, they're going, "I'm not happy. I don't like this. I'm worried. I'm supposed to be cool, man." But then once they get to 5 stories, they're still anxious until they get to 7 stories, and they keep on falling. They've already reached their top speed. They lie back. They have a little cocktail, a drink with an umbrella in it. They relax. And when they hit the ground, they hit with they're already facing the right way down. They hit with all 4 legs. They spread the load evenly through the joints, and the bones are just barely strong enough so that most cats will survive a fall from 32 stories. If you have a fat, hairy cat, it'll probably get up to 120 k's and not survive. If you have a skinny, fluffy cat, 80 k's, it'll walk away from it. Dogs, maybe 150 k's. Humans, 200 k's. There are cases where people do survive a fall from a great height, like a woman did survive a fall from when her parachute didn't open, but luckily she landed on the ground after it had been raining, and according to the fireman, who said that she left a good 12-inch hole into the ground.
Wow.
Okay, so it's terminal velocity.
Is that also to suggest that an animal or a person or whoever can instinctively prepare themselves for a fall?
A cat is really good at preparing itself for a fall. We humans are pretty hopeless, and I had a really scary time with my son and my daughter when they were younger, and we were diving from a pool, and we went from 1 metre to the 5 metres to, oh my God, 10 metres. And 10 metres doesn't sound like much. I had zero control over my body as I was falling, and it wasn't a belly flop, but geez, it was bad. Whereas the cats are much better. They're wired up for it better than we are.
Ouch.
Thanks for your call, Tom.
Thank you very much,
Dr.
Tom.
All right, we've got Andrea now on the phone from the Hume Highway. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning. How are you, Doctor?
Thank you for ringing in, Dr. Andrea. We only take calls from people who are on highways. And what's your question or your answer?
And I hope you've actually pulled over and you're not driving and calling at the same time.
No, my husband's driving.
Excellent.
Because when you're driving and talking on the phone, you're distracted and you are as dangerous as if you are drunk. So good on you, Dr. Andrea.
Absolutely. I never, ever do that.
Anyway, so your question or your answer?
I would like to know what's the difference between an earthquake and an aftershock.
It's sort of tricky. What the people are saying is, are earthquakes related to each other? And so, is the Christchurch earthquake related to the one that happened in Japan at Fukushima with the nuclear reactor there? And almost certainly not. With regard to an earthquake, think about this. You've got the continents on these tectonic plates. There's about 13 of them on the planet. They're moving at the rate that your fingernails grow at. They're always moving, about 5 to 10 centimetres per year. And yet, nothing gives way. Japan is still the same distance from America as it always was. And so the stress builds up. It's pushing, it's squashing. And we have a thing called the stick slip phenomenon, where it's sticking, and then suddenly after 10, 20, 30, 50 years of building up, it slips. And suddenly, Japan slips 2.4 metres. It just suddenly moves. So Japan is now closer to America by 2.4 metres, which means they're going to have to reset all the GPS very slightly and all that sort of stuff. But the point is, then, not all of the stress is relieved. And so you have a flurry of little earthquakes afterwards where they're normally one or two magnitudes down and you have a lot more of them. And at some stage, which is a week, you say, well, that's definitely an aftershock. 10 years is not an aftershock. It's a different phenomenon. Somewhere in between a week and a year, a seismologist knows when you stop calling it an aftershock. And if they could ring into the station, and the number is
1-300-055-36.
Or if you give it on Dr. Carl on Twitter, DOCTORKARL, Dr. Andrea, we should have a number at what is the magic period of time when it is no longer an aftershock but is now a brand new earthquake.
So in principle, the action is the same.
It's still a stick-slip phenomenon releasing, because earthquake tension, like sexual tension, has to be relieved.
Yep.
Thanks, Andrea.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Have a good drive. All right, we've got Adam on the line now from Port Botany. Good morning, Adam.
Morning.
Dr. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Dr. Carl. I've just got a quick question. If I wear a pair of sunglasses that aren't UV-proof, are they doing my eyes more damage than good?
I think they do. They do. Because if you are out at night and it's dark, the pupil opens up enormously, maybe 8 millimetres. And then, when you shade your eye, when you go into the bright light, your pupil closes down to about 1 or 2 millimetres and lets through less light into your eyeball. Then, when you put on sunglasses, your pupil opens a bit.
Right.
Because you're fooling around with the natural order of things by putting on sunglasses, being in Australia where we're not really designed to be. Now, if the sunglasses do not block ultraviolet, you've now got a lot of extra ultraviolet coming through the bad, cheap glass that your sunglasses are made of and straight through the bigger hole at the front of your eyeball and into your eye, landing on the receptor cells. That is not good. There have been articles in various consumer test magazines about these bad glasses. How do you get around it? In general, buy the good quality glasses or anything that's approved of by an Australian standard through an optometrist. The ones that you buy down from a $2 shop, which might have been imported from China, they might be made from UV-resistant glass. They might not. You've got no way of knowing. You can test them, but they'd be more than the glasses are worth. So I actually buy the Cancer Council sunglasses, which are the wraparound ones, and they cost $20, and they make me look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You can't pick the difference. Arnold and me, same difference.
So, thanks for your call, Adam.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Adam.
Dr. Carl is with us this morning taking your science questions. If you've got a science question, give us a call, 1-300-055-36. Dr. Carl is with us this morning. He's answering your science questions. Good morning, Carl from Newcastle.
G'day. Good morning, doctors.
Good morning, Dr. Carl. Welcome to the show. You got a question or an answer for us?
I do, mate. I do. I've got a couple of questions. I know I'm only allowed to ask one, so I've prioritised them.
Yep.
I've got a pool, and I'm always worried about the amount of electricity I'm using and all that kind of stuff. And now I'm going into winter.
Yep.
Is it feasible for me to turn all the pumps off, and I've got a cover for it, put the cover on it, and forget about it all winter, and come back, right at the end of winter, turn the pumps on, get the chemicals going, and get it back up to scratch? Or, I'm just talking about in dollar terms, or keep the chemicals up to it, keep the pumps running because they run it 4 hours at night, 4 hours during the day. I know I've got to reduce them for winter, probably down to about 3 hours per night and day. So the amount of electricity I'm using, I've now got solar on the roof. I'm offsetting my electricity use, but and I'm reducing my electricity through the whole house.
Yeah.
And the power bills are going through the roof.
How many kilowatt hours a day does your pool use? Like we used to, you measure height in metres and weight in kilograms, and you measure the amount of electricity you use. The unit is, standard unit, a kilowatt hour.
We used
to use 28, and now we're down to 8.
Sorry?
We used to use 28, and now we're down to 8. And my solar cells on the roof make 16 in winter, and in the middle of winter, and 34 in the height of summer. Now, how much electricity do you use?
4.4 kilowatt system.
Yeah.
And
how big is yours, sorry?
4.4.
That's decent, man.
Yeah, I live in the bush, so I've got, I don't want to say the energy provider I'm using, but it's a lot more expensive than when I used to live in the city because, you know, they've got to pay for all their power lines to go further distance and less customers and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, the amount of electricity, I'm in New South Wales, so I'm getting a thing back from the government for my usage, but I'm not sure how much I'm actually using for my pool. I think it's about 25,000. I could be wrong. It might be 45,000 litres.
It's very expensive. It takes a lot of energy to pump water around. You can buy, if you go to the supplier, you know, like the... And I mentioned a whole bunch of names: Tandy, J-Car, Dick Smith. Probably that one of those,
so
right?
Get a smart meter or something.
Yeah, get some sort of smart meter, and you'll find that you're using heaps of power. So, firstly, it takes a lot of energy to pump water.
Yep.
Secondly, I don't know the ins and outs of exactly the regime you'd have to take with regard to reducing the amount of pumping that you do. I'd go to a pool supply shop and speak to somebody who knows what they're talking about, and that sort of knowledge doesn't just come overnight. Thirdly, if you've got a 4.5 kilowatt rig, there's really good grounds for you just cutting off from the grid and just going to battery. The trouble is you now have acid and you have lead, but you've got a 10-year life out of them, and you've got to have them always bubbling so they're making hydrogen so it can go bang, so you've got to give room around them. But if you've got a property, you can, in fact, leave enough room around the place.
I'm on 25 acres out of town. So.
Well, you could go off the grid, man.
Okay.
There's grounds for it.
What I wanted to get was a 6.6 kilowatt system.
It's worthwhile going for.
But there was too many trees, too much shading, and the system that I was going to get was actually, it turns off when it gets shaded.
Yeah, if a bit of it gets shaded, it chops off.
I got some slimline ones, so they actually just don't generate as much when they get shaded, so it's actually a better system, but it was more expensive. That's why I got a 4.4 kilowatt system.
I'm jealous. I've got about 4 point. I'm pretty well the same. So look, Carl, check with your local your swimming pool supply people, and if they're competent, they should have a good answer for you. I don't.
So the amount of kilowatt usage and
know how to take care of the swimming pool with regard to the regime you should go to.
Tell me not to turn it off. I know they're going to say that.
They're the experts.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for your call, Carl.
No worries. Thanks for that.
Hopefully Carl gets his answer. We've got Elise now on the line from a beautiful part of the world in Townsville. Good morning, Dr. Elise.
Hi, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Elise, welcome. And Dr. Dom too. You don't want to make him feel bad.
I'm not the real doctor here, though. But
neither am I. I'm a medical doctor.
You have a fascinating question about hiccups and raw carrot.
I do. I don't know if it's a psychological thing or a physiological thing. Whenever I eat raw carrot, and it's only raw carrot, whether it's like one slither of carrot or like a whole carrot, I get the hiccups within a minute. So, yeah, it's really weird.
Number one, I have no idea. Number two, I have heard of this. Number three, the way that hiccups work is that you, for whatever reason, have the diaphragm muscle, which is separating your gut from your lungs, triggering. And it suddenly contracts and it pulls your airways, it pulls your lungs down and air flows in, and it's an uncoordinated activity. If somebody could come up with an answer, please ring in and either give the answer there or on DOCTORKARL, and we'll give you an answer hopefully by the end of the show. I've heard of this. I don't know the answer.
Okay, no worries.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Elise.
Thanks. Bye.
Dr. Carl's with us this morning, answering your science questions. We're going to go to Ainsley now in Brisbane. Good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you? Now, you have a question that I am sure is going to is a little bit controversial.
Yeah, lay it on us, Dr. Ainsley.
Dr. Ainsley.
Come back.
The
forces of evil have wiped out the controversial one. What was his question?
Well, his question was, does hypnosis really work?
Yes and no. It doesn't work in the vast majority of people. There's a really good article about it on the Scientific American homepage. There's a small number of people who are deeply suggestible. And so hypnosis does work on them. If you watch the first series of the Slee Geek Show, which Adam Spencer and myself did, a woman was hypnotized. She was a medical doctor. And we hypnotized her to send me a postcard every day.
And did it work?
Yes.
Oh, really?
So she's a smart woman and she's, you know, she's a doctor, she's a smart woman and she knows what she's doing. And yet, even though she knew that we had hypnotized her to do this, and even though she knew it was stupid, she would then buy a postcard, fill it out and drop it in.
But if I go in to be hypnotized and I go in thinking I can't be hypnotized, is it a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that I can't get hypnotized?
There are some factors which make it... which let you know beforehand whether you can get hypnotized easily or not. And some people can and some people can't. Adam and I are fairly resistant, but some people are susceptible. And it's nothing to do with your moral values, intelligence, height, general goodness or badness. It's just the luck of the draw. We don't fully understand it. But hypnotism is real for some people.
All right, we got Charlie on the line from Albury. Good morning, Charlie.
G'day, Dr. Carl. How are you going?
Very well, thank you, Dr. Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I've got a question about hair on your body.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know why the hair on your arms and legs grows to a certain length and then stops, whereas the hair on your head just keeps growing.
I don't have a good answer for you except to say that it's programmed into the DNA, and as we learn more about the DNA over the next half century, we'll be able to give you a better answer. But that's exactly correct. And so the hair on your skull and everywhere in your body goes through a bunch of phases. It grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. And then, second phase, it stops growing and then just rests and it's held there in the hair follicle by friction. And then the next phase, it gets pushed out by new hair. So the growing cycle is longer on your skull and really short on your eyebrows. And you can see why it's useful to have it big on your skull because, hey, it makes you look really handsome or pretty and people want to have sex with you and have babies. Whereas on your eyebrows... you don't want to have hair falling down blocking your view of the world, although you can't. So it's been genetically determined by evolution, and that's sort of the best answer.
Yeah.
But we don't know why or how it evolved, except to say evolution. We don't know the fine details. We will, but not yet at the moment. That's the best we can do for you in 2011 on the 13th of April.
Thanks for your call, Charlie.
Thank you, Dr. Charlie.
All right,
we're going to go to Ardolf in WA with Alex. Good morning, Alex.
Morning, doctor.
Now, is it Ardroff?
Ardroff, yes, with an R.
Now, where's that's in WA. Where is it in WA? My geography is absolutely terrible.
It's pretty much halfway between Perth and Fremantle.
Ah, oh, nice part of the world.
Between Perth and Fremantle. Hang on. Isn't it supposed to be Fremantle rather than Fremantle?
I'm originally from South Australia, so I wouldn't know.
I got told I pronounced it wrongly when I went to Frio, as we locals call it. Yeah. Yeah, anyway, go on, Dr. Alex.
Okay, so my question is, my mate has a theory. He's a landscaper,
mm-hmm.
and he's also a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
His theory is that the tar from smoking protects his lungs from the corrosive effects of the lime dust that he inhales whilst working.
Oh, no. They work via different pathways, and you do not have that one protects you from the other, but they're both bad.
Okay.
Now, the smoking, if you get any chemical, and pretty well anything from bread to meat to what's in a cigarette, when you burn it, you create a whole bunch of other chemicals that weren't there in the first place by the process of burning. And in the case of tobacco, it's uniquely set up just by the luck of the draw, and I used to be a smoker myself, that it gives chemicals that will set off lung cancers. Separate, and you do get tar and crud inside the lungs, which never comes out until you die. Separately from that, are the bad effects from the lime, which I'm not familiar with. I imagine that, you know, if you're talking about quicklime, calcium oxide, I think is that what quicklime is? I've forgotten my high school chemistry. But anyway, I think that it has bad effects, and I think they're completely separate. They add on top. One doesn't protect you from the other. Smoking is bad, and you end up impotent in your 50s as a male. And so you just talk about it rather than doing it anymore.
Thanks for your call, Alex.
No problem.
Thank you, Dr. Cheers. Alex.
Dr. Carl is in this morning taking your science questions. If you've got a science question, give us a call, 1-300-055-36. Dom Alessio with you, as well as Dr. Carl, who's joining you this morning taking your science questions. We've had an answer about our earthquake question earlier before someone called up whose name has slipped my mind, that was asking what the difference between an earthquake and an aftershock is.
Yep.
Gavin, who is a bona fide geologist, has called in and said the difference between an aftershock and an earthquake is when the seismicity of the area returns to what it was before the quake, and that can take years.
Okay, so he mentioned the word years.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're getting little grumbling aftershocks happening all the time, little tiny ones, some of which you won't even notice, but as long as they're still keeping on going, anything that happens in that area, in that time window, is counted as an aftershock. And it's only, I'm reading between the line here, when you no longer get that abnormal, here comes a fancy word, seismicity.
Yeah.
Seismicity. That'd be a great crossword. Then, once you've returned to normal seismicity, then you can count it as being a brand new earthquake. It's no longer an aftershock.
Yeah.
Oh, look, thank you so much, Dr. Gavin.
Thanks,
very
Gavin.
Kind of you.
And you also have an answer about the hiccups.
Looking here on my good friend Wikipedia and other places, it turns out there's a thing called not irritable bowel syndrome, but irritable diaphragm syndrome. And I haven't managed to get far enough through it. It'll probably take me about 3 hours to fully understand it, but it does seem to be a well-recognized syndrome that carrots can lead to hiccups. And I haven't got an answer, but give me a few hours and I will.
Fantastic. All right, we now have Ben from Ballarat on the line. Good morning, Dr. Ben.
Hey, Gavin.
Ben, welcome to the show. You got a question or an answer for us, Dr. Ben?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I have a friend who's a pilot, and he says sometimes when you're flying, I don't know if it's got to do with altitude or just mind or what.
Oh, I think you're near some kind of transmitter there.
Sounds like a telephone transmitter, but that's all right. Keep going.
Yep. He says when you've been flying for a while, he goes, it feels like the plane's turning, but all the instruments on the plane say you're flying in a straight line. Is this a true sort of thing, or is he sort of pulling my leg?
No, he's dead right. Balance is such a tricky thing, and the whole concept of seasickness. And I'll give you an example of how easy it is to trick your sense of balance. Imagine that you're in a long room, a long skinny room, and it's dark, and you're in the dark, and you're sitting on a chair, and you've got a friend with you, and it's in the dark, and way at the end of the room is a light at the end of the room. And you just lift your arm up and you point at the light.
Yep.
Now, if your friend then comes along and grabs your hand and your arm, if they move your arm in a clockwise circle, your brain will tell you that the light is moving in an anti-clockwise circle.
Okay.
Even though it's not. And vice versa. So knowing where you are depends on a whole, and which way is up depends on balance centers and vision, and even a technical term here, proprioception, P-R-O-P-R-I-O-C-E-P-T-I-O-N, which basically means knowing where your joints are. So if you lift up your arm, you don't need to look at it to know that your arm is up above your shoulder or down by your side. And this can get tricked by long hours of inactivity just sitting in the aeroplane seat.
Hmm.
And then the system might reset itself to think you're moving. Mate, what your friend the pilot is saying is absolutely correct. And that's why we've got to have the thing called the artificial horizon. Don't trust your eyes, trust the artificial horizon.
Thanks for your call, Ben.
Thank you, Dr. Ben.
Thank you very much.
It's like when, you know, if you're sitting in a train and there's another train next to you and the train next to you moves, but you have the sensation that you're moving.
That's right. It's amazing that we humans have got as far as we can with our highly fragile and easily deceived senses.
All right, we got Jacob on the line from Wagga. Good morning, Dr. Jacob.
G'day.
Dr. Jacob, welcome.
How you going?
Hit us with a question.
I have a question about fog. I do an early morning delivery run.
Yep.
And I leave about, say, 3:30, 4 o'clock. And I've noticed some mornings, because I sort of live on the outskirts of Wagga, you'll notice where the fog will sit in real low-lying areas and there may be no fog at all where I wait at home, and then other mornings it'll be right up in the hills,
mm-hmm.
but none in the low-lying areas. I was just wondering why it sort of seems to move around so much depending on the day.
Fog are water droplets floating in the air, but very, very tiny water droplets. And often, following the words of the great man himself, Richard Feynman, all matter is made of atoms. So if you think about little atoms of hydrogen and oxygen forming little boomerangs, which are molecules of water, so you've got these little boomerangs of water, and it's cold, and they stick together. And they're incredibly light. And if you had absolutely no air movement, after a period of time, they would all fall to the ground. There isn't, right? But there's tiny, tiny air movements that's enough to move them because they're so light. And you don't need much, or you don't need a vast number vast quantity of water to cause fog that blocks your vision. If you put on your windscreen wipers when you go through fog, you'll find that you just, after the first bit of water has gone off your windscreen, there's nothing else. You're just sort of rubbing dry glass. So there's not a lot of water molecules there, but there's a lot of, but they're finely spread out. And the point is that the wind will shift them. They're incredibly light, and the wind will shift them. So you need just the mildest wind. What is fun is running through fog, and looking, or you stand still, you walk slow through the fog, and you get somebody to run through the fog in front of you, and you shine a torch on it, and you can see the turbulence behind them. So the first time ever in your life, you can actually see the turbulence of somebody moving through the air expressed by the tiny water droplets. So the answer is the wind, ever so imperceptibly, is moving the fog from the lowlands to the highlands.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jacob.
Thanks for your call, Jacob.
No worries.
I know I really want to nerd out here, but if you go online and check out the film clip for Sydney Band Parades, they did a film clip for a song called Loser Speak a New Tongue, and they actually do that. They slow it down and you can see the air moving.
And what's the name of the film clip?
Loser Speak in New Tongue, which is a...
Loser?
Loser Speak in New Tongue.
Shouldn't it be Losers Speak? Or is it no. Loser, comma, Speak
no,
in New
it's,
Tongue?
No, it's all one word.
Well, one sentence.
Loser Speak in New Tongue.
But they got a singular verb. And
it's music. Grammar goes out the way.
Okay,
grammar
right.
goes out
okay.
the window.
All right.
We've got Dr. Sarah on the line from Geelong. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning,
Dr. Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Now, please bring back some consistency to this show, so I don't go waffling on.
My question's in relation to force, and I was wondering if you're in a car traveling at 100 kilometres an hour, and you hit either a stationary car or a wall. If you were to hit a car that's travelling in the opposite direction at 100 kilometres an hour, is the force the same as hitting the wall or the car?
What you're looking at to work out what forces are applied to you is over what distance does the car slow down. So if you're travelling at 100 kilometres per hour,
yep.
and then you run into a car doing, say, 80 kilometres per hour in the same direction, you'll slow down by 20 kilometres per hour over maybe 10 or 20 metres. If you run into a very light car, just stopped on the road, and you're a fairly heavy car, you might slow down over 50 metres, 20 metres, whatever the distance is. If you run into an immovable solid wall or a vehicle of the same weight travelling at the same speed as you but in the opposite direction, you'll basically stop in... Well, let's put it this way. The front of the car will stay where it is, and your collapsing distance is what distance you slow down over. So if you are normally 1.5 metres from the bumper bar and the car collapses, then and that collapses down to, say, 1 metre, you've slowed down over 1 metre. And so the G-forces are very high. The highest G-forces you can normally withstand without having a good chance of dying about 40 or 50 Gs. So a car coming in the other direction at the same speed with the same weight is equivalent to an immovable brick wall.
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yep, that's answered my question.
And it's a bad, and always wear seatbelts, and airbags are even better as well.
All right.
Thanks for your call, Sarah.
Thanks very much.
We're gonna go to Fitzroy now, and Luke is on the line. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, doctors. How are you today?
Thank you, Dr. Very well. Thank you, Dr. Luke. Welcome to the show. You got a question or an answer for us?
I do indeed. I just had some rags that spontaneously combusted. Someone was using some oil of linseed, and they actually caught a light. Now, my question was, it got us thinking about human combustion, and is this actually possible? If so, how?
Yes and no. I've written a chapter about it in my latest book, but if you go to my ABC webpage in the Great Moments in Science section, look up Dr. Carl, Dr. Carl, and Great Moments in Science, and you'll find it. And there's a story there about people spontaneously bursting into flame. The longer version is a book, but you can get it for free on the ABC homepage.
Okay.
Yes and no. There have been roughly 400 cases of people spontaneously bursting into flame. No, 200 cases over the last 400 years. Not a very high number.
Mm.
The pattern of burning is really unusual. In a house fire, which happens all the time, I'm sorry to say, The extremities are gone, the fingers, the toes, the hands, the feet, but the trunk is still left behind. And somebody can come along, a forensic pathologist, and look at the trunk and say, ah, this is a human. In fact, it was a man, it was a woman. If it was a woman, she had babies, she did not have babies. The trunk is always left behind. You can only get up to 800 degrees C in a house fire. In spontaneous human combustion, if it's real, and I think it might be, but I'm not 100% convinced, it's the opposite. The trunk is turned into powder, and the fingers and the toes are left behind. And I really didn't believe in it until I read an article in The New Scientist by a retired scenes of crime officer in the United Kingdom. That's the equivalent of a forensic officer or whatever they call them in the United States from all those forensic shows, where they use tests that are unknown to the human race and also get their results, not in 3 weeks, but in a few minutes with the cute little girl who's got pigtails. Now, with the spontaneous human combustion thing happening, you have this scenes of crime officer who at the end of his career wrote in to The New Scientist and said, in my career of half a century, I saw two cases which fit this spontaneous human combustion thing. Being a cop, I couldn't say that. So I just wrote them down as they set fire to themselves. And in each case, the room was locked and there was no source of heat inside the room except for the light bulb. No gas fire, wood fire, electric fire. And the room was covered, the walls, with a thin, oily, fatty residue, and the trunk had gone and the fingers and the toes were left behind and there was no other source of heat, and I put it down as spontaneous human combustion. So firstly, if it's real, how does it happen? Well, we've recently discovered a stuff called brown fat in adult humans, and you know, here's something for you, which you probably don't know. If you're a parent, a newborn baby cannot shiver. It's too hard to wire up all that stuff into the brain and get out through the birth canal. It's hard enough to get through the birth canal anyway. So babies, newborn babies, have got a stuff called brown fat. White fat turns energy into fat. Brown fat goes the other way. It turns fat directly into heat. If you want to be technical, the process is called decoupling of oxidative phosphorylation, but let's not get too technical.
You'll be tested on that one.
Yeah, and so you can turn brown fat directly into heat. That's how babies keep warm for the first month of life. So the theory goes like this. Number one, an adult grows, adults have brown fat. We didn't believe it until recently they do. They have lots of brown fat and it goes into a runaway reaction somehow. Number two, we don't know how, but it does. Number two, then you have the famous wick effect where if you get a pig and then set fire to it when it's wearing clothes, the clothes act like a wick, and once you've got the fire going, it'll keep on going. But on the other hand, nobody has been kind enough to do this in a laboratory in front of forensic scientists with all the cameras, so I mostly believe in it, but not quite. Does that answer your question, Dr. Luke?
It does indeed. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Luke.
No worries, guys. Have a good day.
You too, mate. You too.
Bye.
You're on Triple J this morning with Dom and Dr. Carl. If you have a science question, give us a call, 1300 055 36. Dr. Carl is with you this morning, answering your science questions. Good morning to Grace in Sunhill in Victoria.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Grace. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
I was just wondering how, in the olden days, how they made ice, when, because they put ice in the fridge to let it heat up. That's how they did in the olden days. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering how they made ice without freezers.
In Roman and Grecian times, the way that they made ice was simply send some slaves up into the hills to cut out huge blocks of ice, bring them back down into the lowlands, put them into a pit in the ground that was lined with and covered with sawdust, and then this ice, if it was big enough, would survive through the summer. The second method involves technology. Now, I'm going to ask you to do a little experiment for me. You ready to do the experiment, Grace?
What does it involve?
Your hand and your mouth.
Yeah.
Okay, now firstly, in front of the handpiece of the telephone, with your mouth wide open, blow past the handpiece with your mouth wide open onto the palm of your hand and tell me what the temperature is. Okay, I'm going to do it here too.
Amazing radio
now,
right here.
Is that hot or cold?
It's hot.
Okay, now with the same hand and the same mouth, make a tiny little hole with your lips and then blow onto your hand. Is that hot or cold?
It's cold.
Aha. Uh-huh. That is the Joule Kelvin effect, I think. And if you look it up on Wikipedia, it'll explain to you. But that is the basis of how they made ice with machines. That's how the basis of refrigeration. That simple experiment is the basis of refrigeration. Follow through on Wikipedia how stuff works. They're both good sites, and they'll explain to you exactly how they got refrigeration to go. And for a while, Australia got fabulously wealthy by having refrigerated ships selling meat over in the United Kingdom, because they had all this meat here but they couldn't send over except by salting it. And then the invention of refrigerated ships, an Australian invention, made Australia very wealthy for quite a while.
Thanks for your call, Grace.
Thank you, Dr. Grace.
Thank you.
There you go. See, there's experiments you can do at home. Let's go to Billawilla in Queensland now. Good morning, Dr. Wade.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Hey, my question is, I've had a scar. I fell off a pushbike when I was 6 years old, and I got quite a large scar on my arm. Now, it's about one-third of my arm, of the length of my arm at the moment, 19 now. Did it grow with me to stay that same length, or was it initially longer than that?
You have a process of repair going on all the time in the human body. And there are some parts of the human body, like the liver, I think probably the liver is about the only one, there's another one, but I forgot what it is, which can heal back 100%. So you can give your liver, one-third of your liver, to somebody else, and your remaining two-thirds will grow back another one-third, which is identical. If you are an unborn baby still floating around in your mother's uterus, which I'd like to point out is my favorite organ, we can do an operation upon your skin and it will heal with no scars. Once you've been born, you're going to have what's called scar tissue. And scar tissue is different from the original stuff. In a very bad case, it can lead to what's called keloid. K-E-L-O-I-D, which is proud, exuberant tissue that pushes up above the surface, and it looks sort of messy, and dark-skinned people are more likely to it than white-skinned people, and we don't know why, and it happens to white-skinned people, and we don't know why, and it's sort of messy. In your case, the scar occupied a certain length, a certain percentage of your arm, and as your arm grew, it grew bigger with the arm. In general, I don't know if it grew 100%. So if it occupied, say, 30% of the length of your arm, did it grow to be 30% of the adult arm, or maybe 29 or 28? I don't know. And if we have a surgeon, you've got about 1 minute to ring in and give us the answer. So that's kind of answer your question, which is frank, I don't know about that last bit.
Yep.
Thanks for your call, Wade.
Thank you, Dr.
Wade.
Thanks for
that,
eh?
Thank you.
That's like me. I got a giant scar over my knee, so I'm sure that's growing over time as well.
Yeah, but I don't know if it grows in strict proportion or whether it just backs off a little bit. So it's most of the way there, like it's 25% of your knee, and it drops back to 24%, or whether it still stays at a fixed 25% all the way through life from when you started off with a scar. Yeah. This I don't know. I've failed you.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
No. Well, look, we've got time for one more caller, so maybe you can redeem yourself. Tom from Brisbane. Good morning, Dr. Tom.
Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Hey, doctors. How are you going?
Very well, thank you, Dr. Tom.
Just a quick question. When we're sleeping at night, my wife has little twitches, and, like, sometimes the twitches are big twitches, and they actually wake her up. I'm just wondering what causes those twitches.
They're a hangover from the early days, not just of being a baby, but being primates living in trees. If you get a brand new newborn baby, and I used to do this all the time when I was testing newborn babies in the kids' hospital, if you get a brand new newborn baby and lay it on your forearm with the feet in your elbow and the baby's head in the palm of your hand, and you drop your hand, say, 3 centimetres suddenly. Not far, just 3 centimetres.
Yeah.
The baby will drop 3 centimetres, no damage. But the arms will go out quickly and then come back slowly. And the legs will go out quickly and come out slowly. This is called the Morrow reflex, M-O-R-O, and it's thought to date back to times when our ancient ancestors lived in the trees. And if you fell out of a tree while you were asleep, your arms would automatically go out to grab something. And that is thought to be the basis, the Morrow reflex, M-O-R-O, of what is now called the hypnagogic, H-Y-P-N-O, G-O-G-I-C, jerk. Hypnagogic jerk. Look it up on our good friend Wikipedia and trust the references. They're pretty good.
Okay, so she sleeps like a baby then, eh?
You could say that, except babies poo and urinate and make lots of noise. And whatever you want to do, they'll do the exact opposite because of the law of maximum inconvenience and the law of maximum cussedness.
Okay, thanks for the call.
And you still love them because they've got big eyes and small noses.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for your call, Tom.
Thank you, Dr. Tom.
Well, that's all we got time for today. If you do have a science question, hold on to it because Dr. Carr will be back with you next week taking more science questions. Thanks for coming in, Dr. Carr.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dom, and lovely to work with you again.
Again, as always.